Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. From the introduction of Powering the Dream, the History and Promise of Green Technology, you could be excused for thinking there is no history of what we call green technology. If you're reading Time or watching television, listening to Sarah Palin or Barack Obama, according to them, solar and wind are new. Geothermal has barely been tried, and efficiency begins tomorrow. Perhaps some hippies toyed with the off-grid living in the 1960s, and there was some boondoggle in the Carter administration, but the hippies abandoned their communes in the woods. Carter lost to Reagan, so nothing much happened. Maybe a few windmills once creaked on your great-grandfather's farm, or you've heard him tell about how the Tennessee Valley Authority dammed a river with some farm boys. According to those who do remember a few facts from the past, either we should be whizzing around gleaming clean cities in silent cars powered solely by solar panels and microturbines, or green tech is an engineering bust that has been given ample opportunity to prosper, but it has only succeeded in failing spectacularly. There is almost no institutional memory of what happened before the energy crisis of the 70s and little of what happened technologically during the time that has been documented in any serious way. Well, the author of Powering the Dream will set all of that straight. It's a fascinating look. I found much of the history of the promise of green technology and how it was used in various places in the United States and how there was a choice that had to be made. It was either going to be this or this or this, and how we chose oil for the most part. Alexis Madrigal is our guest. He's the author of The History and Promise of Green Technology. He is senior editor at The Atlantic and an award-winning former staff writer for Wired.com, visiting scholar at the University of California, Berkeley, and lives in Washington, D.C. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Today is Chrissy's birthday, so as you're calling in, please wish her all the best in the year to come and the many years to come thereafter. Hi, Alexis. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Isn't it amazing that we just don't know this history off the top of our heads? I love the fact that you've put together all of these inventors and these people who had these great ideas, but yet it's depressing to think that we've just forgotten about them. We've already been there in some instances.
Yeah, it was really an amazing process of research, actually. When I first started out, you know, I remember going to the Library of Congress website, you know, which is sort of iconically called the American Memory Collection. and typing solar into the box, you know, so like, what is the American memory remember about solar? And one thing came up, and it was an old broken down solar hot water heater out in the middle of the Mojave Desert. And I remember thinking, well, maybe there is enough research here to do a book if this is all that we know. And I, at that point, already knew that a lot more existed.
Yeah, we should build on what we were thinking about back in the early 1900s and even before that in some cases. Why didn't somebody collect that body of knowledge so we could have chosen that which was good, that which didn't work, and then move ahead accordingly?
You know, I think a lot of the time with technologies, we don't think about them as choices in the same way that we do, you know, in politics, say. We know so much about how the Constitution was created, for example. I mean, we know, you know, its antecedents in Europe, and we know individual players in the discussions and negotiations around the Constitution. But when it comes to the actual stuff that makes up our lives, like roads and power plants, power lines, these things seem technical. They seem like the experts have to handle it. And so I think as a result, we don't think of them as things we can affect. And we don't remember as a result, and we don't really try to excavate what has gone into those decision-making processes. Because it just sort of seems as like an own contained body of knowledge, just like we don't know about, engineering research, about you know, or we don't know about like quantum physics. It seems like something that's in the realm of specialists, even though these things, you know, power plants, how we send power around the country, affect the lives of each and every person, I would say, as much as our actual paper constitution.
Yeah. Let's go to the car for a moment, and let's go back to the 1900s at the turn of the last century. You write about the fact that we had three type of automobiles. They all used different forms of energies, and each had one-third of the market. Do the backstory here and take us from there.
Sure, sure. So, you know, in the 1890s, it became clear that you could power wheels with these new technologies. You could make them spin. And so the question was, how do you make wheels spin? And there were a few different ways you could do it. You could take gasoline and mix it with air and create a little mini explosion that drove a piston, which then you could translate that energy into the movement of wheels. Or you could have a steam engine, which means, you know, it's actually driven like the steam engines of old, heating up water and using the power of that steam to move the wheels. Or you could take batteries, which at the time were called accumulators, these big lead acid batteries, and you could use the current that was coming out of them to drive wheels. And so all three of those technologies were in play, you know, in 1900. And if you were, you know, in one of the major cities of America, there were very few cars, but there were cars, and you would have seen all three technologies on display.
And we went with gasoline motors because?
Well, there's a lot of different reasons. I think, for one, this is so incredible to think about. The market for petroleum at that time was kerosene. So really what we used oil for in the first, say, 35 years of oil's time in America was lighting. You know, we burned it for light. Kerosene had a nice, at the time, relatively clean burning and nice light that it produced, and so we used it for that. So gasoline was incredibly cheap because it was this waste product of the kerosene production of the time. I mean, I also think that there are really, you know, we sometimes, because, you know, particularly on the environmental side of things, we tend to forget what amazing substances fossil fuels are. They contain tons of energy. But there's another reason, too, which is that there was a company that tried to create this entire alternative transportation system built around electric vehicles and electric trolleys, which blanketed America's cities at the time. That failed, and that company took with it a lot of the dream of an electric-powered transportation system.
Yeah. Well, some of those, you described some of those electric vehicles, they were a little bit cumbersome, weren't they? They were huge. They had a lot of batteries.
Yeah, it's true, although I think it's important to remember that all, you know, when we look back at these old electric vehicles and we compare them, you know, to like a Porsche now, right? But, like, of course, back then there were all of these different vehicles had horrible problems. You know, in fact, they used to bolt on toolkits onto the sides of cars. Even later, even like the Model T times, people would literally bolt on toolkits because things broke down so often that you needed to have your tools right there in case you needed to fix it on the side of the road. It's like the original modding.
Yeah.
There's like a nice parallel with, you know, early computers where, you know, a computer in 1983 was not your MacBook Pro, right? And so if you compare those two things. So they were all kind of clunky. And in fact, the reason people really liked electric vehicles was, A, they weren't, like, stinky in the way that the gasoline-powered cars were. They handled, they were much easier to handle. And in fact, what's crazy, you know, if you think about cars, a technological object, like all these different technologies going into this one system that we call car now, they didn't have the wheel. It's really amazing when you go back to the 1890s, you have all these people who are like kind of driving with this weird kind of stick. And so there's a lot of, you know, at this time, you know, I think the overarching point to make here is that in a lot of these different technological systems that are big and complex, it takes a long time for things to shake out. And some of those things are going to be shaped by the sort of technical factors. Like, it just turns out there are really excellent ways of doing particular things around cars. But others of them are shaped by just kind of what happened, or like socially what made sense to people.
Tell me about this movement. We're looking at the Industrial Revolution here, too. And there was some concern about smokeless cities. You talk about this utopian factory town, and tell me more about that and the inspiration behind that. Because people were dying early on because the air, you couldn't breathe it. It was horrible. And as a result, these things like electric cars and electric transportation and looking at alternatives to gasoline were and coal were a pretty good thing because you could live longer.
Right. I mean, I think one of the things that we have to remember about sort of like the American story of industrialization is that, like, you know, England did it first. So we and the British really had industrialized long before, we're talking decades before the U.S. really got going. And so when the U.S. is and Americans, particularly in the Northeast, are looking at how to industrialize, they have the image of the sort of factory children, right? Like the kind of the chimney sweeps is kind of, you know, you can think of Dickens, right? And like those kind of portraits of society that he's painting. They, people had that in their minds here in the U.S. And they wanted a better kind of industrialism. They didn't want for a lot of reasons, good and bad, they didn't want like a working class that had to labor in those kinds of conditions. And if you were a farmer in Connecticut, you know, in 1840, you would say, "Why would I ever want to go to a factory to work when I have this like life out here in this beautiful place?" And so, one of the things that happened was we developed Lowell, Massachusetts, a group of people called the Boston Associates. Developed this utopian city that actually became one of the most famous cities of the 19th century. Like, everybody would visit there. You know, like, everybody from, like, Davy Crockett to, like, visiting foreign leaders.
Davy
like,
Crockett.
Yeah, Davy Crockett. Seriously, you know, everyone wanted to see this town, Lowell. And the reason was that it used water power to run these amazing cloth factories, textile mills. And they only employed, or mostly employed, young women who kind of rotated through and then went back out to the towns of New England. So it was, they were trying all of these new models for, like, how do you do industrialization without creating, like, sort of a permanent laboring class that, you know, is debased and dying. And also, I think one thing that people forget is just, like, it was clean. And so all of these visitors that came through town saw Lowell as, like, a symbol of actual progress, like what industrialization could be. And so it was both utopian in the sense of, you know, they had all these schemes for educating the women and keeping them, you know, happy, even though they're working 13-hour days under
right,
really difficult
right.
conditions. And they also had this kind of kind of nascent environmental sense that they, even though they were controlling these vast water lands and damming the rivers and all these things, that, you know, this was better than the, you know, having your entire city covered in soot, you know, for decades.
Yeah. Let's move to, because I don't know very much about this, and I'm glad you documented it, and I'm also interested in where it is right now. Mm-hmm. The thoughts about harnessing the waves of the Pacific or the waves of the Atlantic, the wave and tidal industry, has it flourished sometime during history? Where is this now?
Yeah, well, you know, maybe we can work backwards a little
okay.
bit. The wave and tidal power industry still exists. And in fact, particularly in the North Atlantic, like the British are looking like very seriously at wave power. You know, it's a difficult, you know, just sort of proposition, right? You have to convert the sort of vertical, that is, you know, so the kind of the waves going up and down, or the sort of horizontal motion of the waves into electricity. And the way that you generate electricity, right, is you rotate in this very smooth and steady fashion a magnet around a coil, and then current comes out. And so as a result, it's like that translation is actually incredibly difficult, even though we can all see that there's essentially infinite power in the waves. And in fact, this, to me, it's almost like the perfect definition of the sort of problem and promise of renewable energy. I mean, to the point that when I finished my book, I actually got a wave motor from the 1890s.
Really?
Tattooed on my right arm, yeah.
No, are you serious?
Yeah. both as a commemoration of the book, but also because it's such a perfect, to me, it's just like the perfect metaphor for
oh, that's
you know,
great.
The kind of the dream of a better power. And in fact, also, I mean, the other reason is that my sort of contribution to history, I think, in some ways, is really looking into the wave motors of the 1890s and early 20th century along the coast of California, where there were all of these Californians kind of starved for power, starved for electricity, and yet there they are looking at the Pacific Ocean, you know, the like this powerful roaring entity. And I just I loved the way that they thought about it, and I loved just how many sort of feverish teams of inventors were sitting there, you know, drooling over this opportunity to, you know, create infinite electricity for, you know, the burgeoning cities of California.
You'll never be able to put this book to bed, though, because you've got this tattoo now. You'll have to talk about it forever.
Well, I think that's, you know, at a certain point, I think I'll just start saying it was about my book.
Oh, okay. Read the book.
Yeah, read the book.
Yeah, here you go. Just read the book. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The book is fascinating. It's Powering the Dream, the History and Promise of Green Technology. One of the things that's amazing is all the history that Alexis has been able to highlight in this book, history that, by golly, we ought to know, because you have to learn from where you were to decide where it is you're going to be. These ideas that we think of as so completely new have been around and tried, some successfully, some not. The decisions that were made to go one way rather than the other, documented in his book, Powering the Dream. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. And the email is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls, starting with Jerry in Appleton. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. My question was about a couple of years ago, I read a book called The Gavio Test. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right. It was about a village in South America where they came up with different technologies to power their village. They came up with a solar kitchen, a pump that was run by kids playing on a seesaw, and then a hospital that was all run off sustainable energy. And then, according to the book, they came back and they kind of started talking about that technology, and they gave Carter solar panels, and he put up solar panels. And then when Ronald Reagan was elected, he took them all down. But I was wondering if any of those technologies or any of those specific designs have been implemented in today's world or after that event. Thanks.
Sure. Well, there's a couple different things. I mean, solar cookers of various sorts have definitely been tried. I think you know, there are still many people who are working on that in the kind of humanitarian design field. It certainly works. I mean, you could just get, you know, if you have a box of glass and then you put another box of glass inside of it, you can cook with it, and people have. I think it's just hard, you know. I mean, given that it's difficult to get people to cook, you know, even on a normal stove, you know, when you add the element of not knowing whether or not it's going to be sunny and sort of time requirements of that, it's been difficult to really push those out. And in fact, there's a kind of famous case study where some people actually from the University of Wisconsin, a guy named Farrington Daniels, who was both a nuclear scientist and later a big solar proponent, you know, went down to Mexico and tried to sort of be like, hey, you don't need fuel anymore. You can just use the sun. And the people eventually, you know, who they tried to sort of deploy this technology on didn't like it. So I guess that's one. In terms of the solar panels on the roof of the White House that Jimmy Carter put up, those actually are a fairly standard design. Really what they were was they were solar hot water panels. And so, you know, we can think about harnessing solar energy in a bunch of different ways. The kind of the two common ones for people are to use photovoltaics. So that's, you know, just panels that directly convert the light of the sun into electricity, which then you can use to do all things for electricity. But before that, there was solar hot water heating, which essentially was developed actually late 19th century in California again, in essentially coils of water inside a glass box with a storage tank. And those kinds of panels will heat water well. In fact, they are cost competitive in many, many places. And in China, there are tens of millions of people who use solar hot water heating. It's just here in the U.S., you know, again, a technology that we developed and essentially perfected, we're now, you know, basically don't use at all, while other countries use a lot. Mm.
Let's talk more about photovoltaics. You have said that if they continue to improve over the next decades, they could be the key element. Let me repeat, the key element of our energy future.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple things that give me hope about that. I mean, I think if you look over the last 50 years at their improvement, it's just been astounding in terms of getting cheaper as well as getting more efficient, as well as like all the other things that we kind of forget. You know, if you're going to put these things on your roof, it's a little bit like getting your kitchen remodeled, right? It's like it's actually like a home improvement project. And so people have gotten better at doing all of the little business things around that. Like, you know, if you want to get solar panels on your house, like how do you go about it? Now there's websites that help you go through things, and you can use like Google Maps to position panels on your roof and figure out how well they perform, et cetera. So that's one piece, but there's also there's also the material science, which is sort of the infrastructural knowledge that we need in order to create these things, has been improving rapidly. And one of the big reasons is that before, you know, you could think of material science, like before we had other names for it, like metallurgy, right? It was like dealing with metals and how to create better steel, say. But it was really a kind of bench science, as they say. It was something where you had to do experiments with like a human being. You know, not exactly pouring stuff back and forth, but kind of like pouring stuff back and forth, you know, kind of traditional chemistry beaker stuff. Now they're able to do a lot of material science work just on computers with simulations and models of these materials. And anytime you can sort of use the computer's speed and ability to sort of process in massively in parallel, you can get major advances. You like want to be hooked up to Moore's Law. And so that's kind of what's happening in material science. And I think what we're going to see over the next 10 years, that it just gets better and better and better and better. And the materials that are available will grow in the same way.
Hmm. Ryan in Lake Mill, Illinois. Hi, Ryan.
Hello.
Hi.
Actually, it's Brian.
Oh, hi, Brian.
Lake Villa.
Lake Villa.
I was wondering if the author covered Nikola Tesla and the suppression of technologies by Westinghouse and Edison for monetary gain.
Well, I mean, that's kind of one of the greater themes of the book, I would say, is that a lot of the time there were people who came up with things, but they didn't fit into the sort of profit-making system of the time. And so as a result, you had them sort of get pushed to the side. I mean, I think there's a lot of, I think, particularly around Tesla, you know, who's a brilliant inventor. There's a lot of, I think, people who want to believe more about him than maybe it's completely supportable. But certainly, I think the idea that electric companies have wanted to control the technologies so that they can control the sort of money generated from electricity is indisputable.
Let's talk just a little bit more and look at what we mean by your saying this. The cost of renewable energy, you write about coal in the book, and it can be as low as 5 cents a kilowatt hour. You write, right or wrong, cheap things win, so clean energy has to get cheaper.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough thing. The way that fossil fuels interact with our economy is one of the most difficult problems of our time. I mean, my analogy for it is essentially fossil fuels are essentially like kids who live with their parents but have a summer job. So society is paying all of their costs. You know, anytime they get into trouble, they bail them out. But because they have a summer job, they have this, you know, disposable income that they
right.
can spend on lots of things, including getting, lobbying and other types of political power. And I think we, you know, if you support renewable energy, Renewable energy, you know, doesn't get into as many scrapes and has to pay for a lot of its own costs, right? It doesn't get to dump as much on its parents, so to speak. And so I think that's what, you know, economists and other people call this sort of externality problem, right? Society pays for a lot of the downsides of fossil fuels in terms of people's health, in terms of environmental problems, et cetera. And yet, you know, the profits go to the people who sell the fossil fuels. And I think that's a problem that we haven't figured out, right? It's been identified for 50 years, and people aren't really sure what to do about it. I think as a result, and particularly, you know, even if we could do it here in the United States, right? I mean, what about places where, you know, people don't have access to any electricity, large swaths of the developing world? I think if we really think about the energy challenge in its, like, biggest, you know, way, it's really to decarbonize, like, to essentially stop using fossil fuels here in the United States and other developed countries, as well as sort of, you know, providing electricity to people who don't have it, because it's just so useful. Yeah. And it's a key way, it's a key part of getting out of, you know, really abject and serious poverty. And so I think we need to develop things that are cheap enough for everyone in the world to be able to use. And I think that's why I said that.
Mm-hmm. Brian, thanks for your call. Dave in Madison, hi.
Hi. Really enjoying the program so far. And I guess I was just wondering if there are any historical lessons that we could draw upon to figure out how to get around what is referred to in the economics literature as network effects and lock-ins to being locked into a particular standard. So, for example, I'm thinking of how we have a whole infrastructure set up around automobiles that burn on gasoline, but we don't have an infrastructure set up for a purely electric alternative, such as charging stations and things like that, would make a more viable alternative. And it would seem like in order to have sufficient demand to create such an infrastructure, you'd need people with a certain critical mass of electric cars that are going to use them. But at the same time, you're not going to have people that have electric cars until the mm-hmm. infrastructure exists and the charging stations are out there.
Yep.
So it seems like we kind of have a little bit of a chicken and the egg problem. And I'll take my question off the air.
Okay, thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
Yeah, thank you, Dave. That's a great question. And I guess I'll give two answers to it. One is simple in theory, but very difficult in practice. And I think it's you essentially get the government to do something about it. a great example of that is, you know, in the 1980s in California. You had a young guy who'd worked with this kind of rogue group of scientists called the New Alchemists, who was looking at the problem of wind power, and he was saying, well, you know, there's no wind machines because there's no money to be made in wind, and there's no money to be made in wind because there's no wind machines, right? It's another version of the chicken and the egg problem.
Yeah.
And so what he did was just created, you know, and I think he even called it TNT, created these incredibly generous incentives around, you know, building wind farms in California, and essentially sparked a lot of the what we now know of as sort of the modern wind industry, as people got involved in that business in response to those tax incentives that Jerry Brown let go through, and that, you know, really have made California a site of the you know, kind of green tech industry, like the major site possibly in the world. So sometimes that happens, that people decide that that investment is worth it in sort of tax incentives. But another way, and this one is just kind of a fun story too, we were talking about the electric vehicles around the turn of the century, right? And one of the things that if you were kind of looking out at America in 1900 that you would have noticed, or really like let's say 1890, is that there were very few roads connecting cities that were paved. Right, so these are just like rutted trails, almost, right? And there were very few roads that you would have wanted to take a car on. So the sort of major advantage of you know, gasoline powered cars is that it was really easy to take them for long distances, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there were no roads to go the long distances on, and so what actually ended up happening is that bicyclists who had a similar set of concerns and who there were way more of, right? There are you know, millions of bicyclists at that point already in America, just because there was this huge boom right around like 1895, 1896. They started agitating through something called the Good Roads Movement, which was funded by the biggest bicycle maker in the country, this guy Pope, to pave roads, and not just to pave roads, but to put, you know, tourist information, to you know, put all the soft infrastructure and giving people maps so they knew how to tour, just all the information that you would sort of need to make that stuff worthwhile, the infrastructure of touring. And so essentially, as bicyclists became this sort of potent political pressure group, they in fact did get roads paved, and they came up with ways of financing those things in various places, tried to convince farmers that it was really in their best interest, even though it was the bicyclists who wanted the roads, and it worked. I mean, roads really started to get paved, and that movement was very successful. And then cars piggybacked on the top of that and promptly brushed them off the road. So I guess the lesson to draw there is that you can ride on a more potent political group, so to speak. You could draft behind a group that has consonant infrastructure interests.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, the utility industry, in particular, this is a huge market for them. If they, you know, utilities, you know, the people that we know, you know, Con Edison or whatever, right? I mean, they sell electricity. They're not involved in the transportation business, but they also want to sell more electricity. In fact, you know, still in our statistics, we call this electricity sales. And so I think they want to get involved, and in fact, they in that market and of transportation. And I think that's pretty much the way that you do it, is you go in through some big entity like the utilities who wants to create that infrastructure.
Let's talk about it. And it's where you start your book, about what we need to do perhaps to save the world, which is something that's, you know, fairly important. You start your book with this world's techno elite gathering at the TED conference, excuse me, in California, where you have a guy who's a big tech guy. Tell me about him, John.
Sure.
Deere, is it?
John Doerr.
John,
yeah.
Doerr, who's crying about the future of the world. Tell us that story and how concerned and influential these techno elites will be in guiding us in some of what we've been talking about.
Yeah, it's really, you know, it's interesting. You know, I think traditionally the environmental movement has had a really conflicted relationship with technology. And so when, you know, TED is this big conference out in California that has become famous for gathering together, you know, all the, you know, from Bill Gates to, you know, designers of various sorts, you know, all these founders of companies, and really, you know, people both who have wealth, influence, and actual technical chops. And, you know, for a long time, like, the environment wasn't really on their agenda. And then in 2007, John Doerr gave this talk where he described his daughter getting in his face about his generation having, you know, endangered the world through climate change, essentially, you know, creating climate change. It was really kind of in the 20th century that this became a problem because of how much fossil fuel we burn, because of how energy intensive our society is. And Doerr, who is a partner at a major venture capital firm in California, sort of put out a call that people needed to get involved in creating new energy technologies so that we have solutions to the problem of global warming. And really what that problem comes down to is we have solutions to the problem of burning coal and natural gas to make electricity and burning oil to run our cars. And I think the thing that's really significant about this, and one of the reason why I chose to write about green technology as opposed to just green stuff, is that technologies can get better. Technologies are part of the sort of narrative progress in this country, but we haven't really married them to the environmental ethic before in quite this way. You know, the environmental movement has been about stopping things from getting built, coal plants. It's been about conserving land, And if we really want to beat climate change, we actually have to put an entirely new energy infrastructure in place, which means we need to build a lot of stuff. And we're going to need people like John Doerr. We're going to need people who know how to do that, build companies and create new technologies in order to have those solutions. And I personally think that's really exciting because that's the kind of environmental movement that I'd like to be involved with. And I think there's a lot of excitement about it in a lot of places that maybe wouldn't traditionally care that much about like nature in the sense of, you know, forests and wilderness.
Mm-hmm. Bill is our next caller on the road. Hi, Bill.
Hello. During the program. But, you know, one of the callers, and I guess you tangentially touched on something of a pet peeve of mine. My father used to work for Ford Motor Company on alternative engine and power research. He was working on things like Stirling engines and turbine engines and even electric cars and stuff like that back in the 1950s.
Oh, cool.
And said the problems were not just a matter of cheapness, they were a matter of convenience. Electric cars, for example, were perfect in many ways. They were the fastest. They were winning all the races back in the early 1900s. They were the fastest. They were the easiest to handle. They were just dreams to drive. Everybody loved them, except for one thing: the power density was so poor. Mm-hmm. Because the batteries were very heavy, and you drive whatever range they have, and you have to wait 7 or 8 hours before you can drive anymore. And that's the convenience factor. Gasoline engines, for all their technical problems, I mean, they were troublesome, they broke down, they stunk, they oozed oil, all the problems that everybody knows about, especially about early gasoline cars. They had one huge advantage, and that you if you ran out of what powered them, you just dumped
more
in some more, and away you
mm-hmm.
went.
Yeah. It's a really interesting point that you make. I think what's fascinating is that people tried to come up with a solution to that we actually have come back to today. There was this company called the Electric Vehicle Company, the one that tried to create this all-electric infrastructure, actually created a battery swapping station. Like, their idea was that you would have electric vehicles as a service. Like, you would purchase, they were electric taxi cabs, actually. And what's amazing is that they actually did create a swapping station so that the cabs could drive in and these big hydraulic machines would pull out this rack of batteries and then put in a new one, and then the cab could get back out on the street. And in fact, that's the model for Better Place, which is Shai Agassi, another one of these sort of technology guys turned energy and transportation folks. That's actually his model for Better Place, his company. And one that has, could get some traction because it solves not perfectly the convenience problem that you highlighted, but it gets around some of the bigger problems there in terms of having to wait all that time.
Thanks, Bill, very much for the call. More phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour is Alexis Madrigal. His book is Powering the Dream. And it is a look at the history and the promise of green technology. It's a fascinating history and one that we should know and remember, but we don't. So he wrote the books, and now we will. We'll take more phone calls in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to an email that's come in from Scott in Onalaska. In the 1884 printing of Knight's New Mechanical Dictionary, there are descriptions of a solar power boiler, something called a solar caloric engine, a solar cooking apparatus, a solar lamp, and a few descriptions for various solar-powered scientific laboratory types of equipment.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the thing that's just amazing is that there was a guy named, John Etzler, who...
Oh, John, yeah.
Yeah, one of the kind of early characters in the book, who wrote this this incredible kind of bizarre techno-utopian treaty that's actually kind of wonderful. It's called, and I'm going to try and remember the name off the top of my head. It's called The Paradise Within Reach of All Men by Powers of Nature and Machinery.
It's wonderful.
Without labor, an address to all intelligent men. And in it, he imagined essentially the solar boiler. I mean, we're talking this is the 1830s, and essentially he said, you know, we'll take all these mirrors, these flat mirrors, and we'll put them around a boiler, and we'll focus the sun's heat on it, creating steam, which then can drive a turbine, and then you know all these things that go from there and go into generating power. And you know the idea that someone could come up with such a thing, although I guess he was thinking purely kind of a traditional steam engine, way before it existed, is kind of amazing. But mm-hmm. if you think about it, when people didn't have fossil fuels in these huge amounts that we now do, they were sort of forced to look at natural energy sources more greedily. You know, there's all these great descriptions of people in the Northeast and also in the Midwest looking for like any sort of fall of a river, because if the river was sort of falling, they could take advantage of that and use it to drive a factory. And so I think we kind of tend to forget how important energy was in people's lives and how much more I think people really understood it, because the quantities were sort of a little bit more human. You know, it's really difficult to look at a power plant and understand how powerful it really is. It's a lot easier to look at something like an old school windmill that pumps, you know, a certain amount of gallons per minute, or to look at a water wheel that we can actually see and understand its power in terms of like how fast a river is flowing.
We go to Andy next in Clintonville. Hi, Andy.
Hi, this is a great show, great program, great topic. Thank you. If I'm hungry right now and I want to get some food, I can literally go hundreds of places. I can go to a gas station, a restaurant, a grocery store. I can grow my own food. But if I need energy, there's only a small number of groups that I can get that from. And I'm really interested in how those few groups are stopping these new technologies from coming out right now, not back in the time of Tesla. But what kind of technologies do we have right now, and what corporations are out there stopping them? And I hope you name names.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's interesting. It's like in a lot of these systems, it's the stopping of the technologies is more about their entrenchment in sort of the market, in making things convenient for people, right? I mean, there's actually a lot of places you could go if you were like truly motivated. I mean, certainly not as many as to get food, but there's a lot of places you could go to get electricity. I mean, there are small wind turbines that you could install in your home. There are different kinds of solar power, both in terms of photovoltaics, solar hot water heating. There are different types of geothermal pumps that exploit the kind of difference in heat between, you know, far down in the ground and sort of up at the surface. The problem is that a lot of these things require like kind of a substantial upfront investment, and for most people, it's just easier to plug in. I mean, I'm not saying there have not been bad corporate actors. I mean, certainly, the big problem of the 20th century was that these utilities in particular, combined with General Electric and Westinghouse, wanted to drive people to greater and greater electricity use. And this actually has a lot to do with the problems we have today, because as a guy named Philip Sporn, who was a big utility executive, once said to a group of his peers, you know, the loads that matter, that is to say the electric loads that matter, are the ones that we invent. And so they really did. They went about trying to get people to use more electricity at every turn through advertising campaigns, through sort of giveaways where they would give away some thing, kind of like the way that your iPhone is subsidized. They would like subsidize, you know, your air conditioner or your electric heating. And, you know, it was all to kind of suit their corporate imperatives and continue to drive sales. I think all of that was sort of underpinned by this idea that there was a sort of infinite amount of energy available, and a lot of that had to do with the kind of nuclear dream and the idea that electricity would get cheaper. But I think it also had to do with just this idea that progress meant more and more energy use. And so what ended up happening, when you have these incredibly energy-intensive lives that we do in the United States, it makes it harder and harder to switch, right? It's as if we've developed a very, very fine palate, to go with this food metaphor. And there's really, you know, if you want a very expensive bottle of wine, there's probably only a few places that you can really go, right? And so that's kind of or if you wanted to get something, you know, yeah, I mean, they're just, we've created a system that can only be served by these corporations. And that's the sort of lock-in problem that one of the earlier callers mentioned.
You mentioned, when you were looking at solar energy, that in the 1970s, the most important technological work was done by an oil company, and I can't remember the name of the company at this moment. What happened to that oil company's research in solar, and why did they decide even to get involved in solar?
Right. Well, this is like one of these fascinating moments where like the interests of the oil companies aligned quite nicely with the sort of interests of you know, the people, which it doesn't happen that often, right? I mean, they benefit from expensive oil while we all suffer from it. What happened in this case is that they had a need for power on oil rigs. You know, diesel fuel is sort of expensive. You have to keep the generators going and all these things. And so they started to look into photovoltaics panels in order to drive buoys and other sorts of things that were related to the offshore oil industry. And, you know, the research sort of has been incorporated into sort of solar research in general, but they really did actually, several companies did in fact do incredible research on improving photovoltaics. And there's a researcher named Gregory Nemeth there, in Wisconsin. Actually, I think he used to be at Berkeley, but now I think he's in Wisconsin, who sort of tracked in the most interesting ways sort of how solar panels have gotten cheaper, essentially. And one of the big ways is just being able to make more of them, scale, as energy people like to call it. And in order to get scale, you need a market, and the oil companies provided that market.
Well, that's a fascinating story. Andy, thanks very much for the call. You go to Karen next in Madison. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I have a story to tell you about a historical event that only becomes more painful as the years go by. In the late 70s, President Carter devoted quite a bit of government money to developing alternative energy sources. And at that time, I was working for a division of General Electric that was developing fuel cells. Mm-hmm. And they were on the cusp of being deployable, and they were fantastic as a source of energy. In fact, a fuel cell could be the answer to this problem of where do you plug in your electric car. They're safe. They use water as fuel. They're incredibly clean. Anyway, the day after Reagan was elected, the phones rang, and government officials said, stop working because all the money is going to disappear by the time Reagan is inaugurated. And sure enough, by April, all the money that had been in alternative energy resources and development went into weapons, and all of us were laid off, and the division that had been working for 50 years on something that was almost on the cusp of being deployed was demolished. And so one of the things that gets me is that if we had just kept going at that time with even a small amount of development, these fuel cells would be everywhere, and we wouldn't be having these problems. And it can be very painful to look back at these things.
Oh, I imagine. Very painful.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, that's a story that I heard in different forms, you know, many, many times in the course of writing the book. I mean, if there really is a villain in the story, it's Ronald Reagan. I mean, you know, his administration came in with the intent of just essentially destroying renewable energy R&D, and they did. Really effectively, actually, and it's what's really sad about it is that there were so many programs started during the 1970s. I went out to the Solar Energy Research Institute, which now is the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, and just kind of looked through all the things that they were exploring in their library in the late 1970s. And there were so many ideas which have come back around. And they were beginning work on them. They were, it was the finest group of renewable energy researchers ever assembled, particularly including the contractors, like people at General Electric and other places. And they were completely gutted. And I think, it's a sad thing. And it's something that we maybe should have expected. But in fact, when Ronald Reagan was running for office, he actually had a pretty extreme libertarian on his group who actually loved renewable energy and wrote a few of his speeches in which he spoke kindly of renewable energy because of its ability to allow society to sort of decentralize in the way that some conservatives feel would be a good thing. So it's a sad story, and I'm sorry to hear it. And it's an unfortunately common one.
Well, it leaves you with, if only we had, if only we had, if only we had.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, your book is fabulous, and what an interesting conversation. Alexis, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Yeah, good luck with that tattoo.
Thank you.
It's a great story. Our guest this hour, Alexis Madrigal. His book is Powering the Dream, The History and Promise of Green Technology. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing the hour, and thanks to Chrissy Pease, and happy birthday to her, for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. I'm Kathleen Dunn. I'll be with you again next Tuesday. I have a furlough day tomorrow, and we'll be off on Memorial Day for my son's birthday. So until then, have a great weekend. This is the Ideas Network.